All right, welcome to class. Sorry I'm a minute late. Didn't get into the room in time to get my tech set up. Before we dive in, are there comments, questions, concerns, other things for me? I realized 30 minutes ago that I hadn't put any links for Thursday's class. And I thought, oh no, I better do it before class. And then I thought, this late in the semester, who's actually reading in advance? Does anybody care if I put up links before class? Yeah. All right. I will probably still do it most of the time just because it keeps me on track. But anyway, I assumed that at some point we had all forgotten to try that. All right. As I was just thinking about how things look, I thought about something that I think we haven't talked about how it looks yet. Let's talk about stop signs and all kinds of road signs. What is odd visually about road signs? They're shiny, but only at night. Right? You never go up to a sign and say, what a shiny sign during the day, but at night they shine. How do they do that? Does anybody happen to know the name of this optical property? This is called retroreflection. Okay? Retroreflection meaning it shines back the way it came. There are various chemical properties that can create this, but the simplest way to describe a common property of most of them is to talk about mirrors. In particular, a corner mirror. If we had, in 2D, two mirrored surfaces meeting at a right angle, and we shoot any ray at any direction, sort of near-ish the corner, when it hits one of the mirrors, it will reflect in one axis. When it hits the other one, it will reflect in the other axis, and it will end up coming back the opposite direction it entered. Maybe slightly offset. It doesn't matter how close to the corner we get. It doesn't matter what angle we come in at. All that matters is that we manage to hit both of these. And this also works for the corner of a cube. We create three reflective surfaces like the inside corner of a cube. Any photon that comes in will bounce off of each of the three and come back out the opposite direction it came in, right? And so this basic property is the property of retroreflective things. It's the things that make things safe at night, now that we have lights, because it shines light back at the source. Now, it isn't perfect. We actually don't want it to be perfect, because if it shined all light exactly back at the source, you would have your car, right, with its headlights, and you'd have a sign that is shining all of the light back at the headlight, and you wouldn't be able to see it. So we actually intentionally want them to have slightly wrong angles. So it doesn't go exactly back, it sort of goes out in some sort of cone. Fortunately, that's not hard to do. Making things precise is not particularly easy, right? But we can do all kinds of sort of cubical or related crystal structures. So table salt has some retroreflective property, although it turns out not to have great total internal reflection, so it's not a great one. But we make anything with sort of a cubical structure, and if we want to make it a little bit weirder, we put some sort of transparent thing that isn't perfectly smooth over top if it is too perfect internally, and poof, we get retroreflection. Because this tends to require some sort of depth, you will notice that retroreflective things, for example, on clothing tend to be sort of thick and stiff. Because making it sort of arbitrarily thin that work on fibers is not an easy thing to do, although we get better all the time. So at some point we may see that. If you ever see somebody doing like the big white strips at the intersections of like at stop signs and so on, you will notice what they do is they pour powder, little granules that have retroreflective properties down, and they put some sort of adhesive over top. Although the spraying on the sides of the roads ones do this in all in one step, because at the end we have these little cubical granules that are key to many of these retroreflective things. Anyway, anything else you want to talk about what it looks like before we talk more about fluids? Okay. So now I want to ask, let's talk about the difference between watercolor and latex paint. If you were given a paintbrush and told to, I don't know, paint a smiley face, would you rather use latex paint or watercolor? Yes? Why?
Because watercolor
Yeah, water curls spread all over the place. Okay? Water is not a great paint. Partly this is because it's too thin. So what if we just sort of make thick water? We add some dust. Would you rather use mud or paint? Turns out paint isn't very much like mud. And the real thing that's going on here is what we generally call Newtonian fluids. So Newton postulated that fluids could be described using just the two things we talked about last time, this conservation of momentum and incompressibility. He actually postulated that we don't need incompressibility and had a way of dealing with pressure as well, which will do things with like smoke and so on and allow sound to exist. It's quite handy. All fluids are compressible at high enough velocities, which is how sound travels through things. But he had those two forces, conservation of momentum, which creates self-advection, and then this incompressibility, and added to that, so I should write these down because I'm about to have the third one. So we have incompressible, we have momentum, and then the third one Newton suggested, so the Newtonian fluids had viscosity. Viscosity is described as the likelihood that two particles moving past each other in different directions will decide to go the same direction instead. It's how much the fluid flow one area impacts the fluid flow in another area. Viscosity for fluids we're most common with, like water and air, is actually relatively low, which is how you can have, for example, something like a tornado, which exists in a place. And it doesn't just quickly spread out and make the whole atmosphere sort of swirl around because the viscosity of the air is pretty low. And so you have some high wind speed next to some low wind speed with relatively little transference of that. So these are things that Newton suggested deals with different fluids. And this can describe a lot of useful fluids, right? Incompressible is liquid as opposed to gas. Gases are compressible. Momentum is generally always there. And then viscosity can come at varying levels and can make thin versus thick fluids, okay? But it's missing a couple of important properties which make them non-Newtonian, which we'll go to next. Before we go on, questions about these three? All right. Let's talk a little bit about non-Newtonian fluids. So here are some examples of non-Newtonian fluids. Ketchup, custard, toothpaste, starch, maizena, honey, paint, blood, and shampoo. What is it that makes these things weird? All right, we have this delightful and weird little graph that we're going to talk about a little bit to see if we can really truly understand non-Newtonian fluids. This is a graph of shear to stress. What does shear and what does stress mean? Anybody happen to feel like they can define, shear rate and shear stress. These are both shears. So these are sometimes also called stress and strain. What is shear? Does anybody know what shear, yes?
Shear is force applied parallel to a plane.
Shear is force applied parallel to a plane. Okay, so if you pull on something like a cable, that's tension. If you compress something like a post, that is compression. There's also bending, which doesn't really apply to fluids at all. And the other kind of thing you can do is shearing. Shearing is how you open bags. Although you probably aren't thinking about it, you get your fingers close together and you move them in opposite directions to try to create a force that's tangent to the plane you're imposing by your two hands, and so on. Okay? So shear forces are what viscosity does. Viscosity says, this particle is moving quickly this way, and that one isn't. Okay, so as they pass each other, there is a shear between them. The shear rate is the difference in the velocity in that direction. Okay, so if one of them was moving quickly and the other one was moving more slowly, this difference would be the shear rate. And viscosity just says, shear rate drops. Okay? If I have a high shear rate, I will transfer some energy between each other. Okay? There's other ways of posing it as averaging energy and so on. Shear stress is how much force is being applied, or how much pressure exists. Okay? And Newtonian fluids, that doesn't matter. As you put more force, you get more flow. Okay? But other kinds of fluids, pseudoplastics and dielants and Bingham plastics and Bingham pseudoplastics, which we usually don't use these words in graphics for various reasons, behave differently. Okay? So latex paint has this, what we call its shear thinning. The more force, the more shear force there is, the less viscous it becomes. This is actually very important for paint. We want paints, all good paints will have this property. We want to be able to dip the brush in paint and have a glob of paint stay on the brush. When there is no force, we want it to be thick and sticky. But then we also want to be able to drag the brush across a piece of paper and create a very thin trail of paint behind. So at that place where the brush presses the paint against the paper, we don't want it to be thick and glumpy. We don't want it to act like clay. We want it to be nice and thin like water. So it'll spread out over the paper and then we can pick up the brush. The force goes away, it all stays put. This is a property we want of paint. There are a lot of other things that have this property, like mayonnaise. Okay? For exactly the same reasons, we like mayonnaise to have these properties. We want it to stay on the knife and spread on the bread. Okay? So we have these shear thinning properties. There are a handful of rather strange materials that are shear thickening. Then you apply force, they get thicker. Can anybody name or identify such a material? Yes?
Like the cornstarch thing?
Yeah, the cornstarch thing is a classic example. Yeah.
Maybe like chewing gum?
Chewing gum? I don't actually know. It's elastoviscous. We'll get to that in a moment. I don't know if it's shear thickening or not. Yeah. Most of the best known ones are all sort of created for that purpose. So there's the cornstarch water stuff. There is the borax glue stuff. There is silly putty has this property, where it will have this behavior that when you, like you can throw it and it'll bounce as a ball, but then you can squeeze it flat, right? Okay, so we have these shear thickening things. Most of them are interesting because they're shear thickening. It's not a common phenomena to notice in nature, okay? So the shear thinning means that as the stress increases, the rate increases. These are the dielants. Okay? We also have things called Bingham pseudoplastics. Bingham plastics are less commonly used, but Bingham pseudoplastics are fairly commonly used. And this tends to be things like modeling clay. It requires some amount of stress before you get any flow. Okay? And then whether a whole lot of stress makes it sort of runny or not is usually not something we care about, because usually you want a big block of it to be able to sit there in gravity and not fall down. But we want to push hard on it and be able to mold it. So these plastics tend to be good clay type of material, modeling clays. The dielants tend to make good paints and other spreadable things. And so we have these different kinds of materials. To model all these in a computer, we have to somehow be able to model how much stress there was so we can change the viscosity. Okay? We'll actually have to model other weirder things that we may or may not get time to talk about today. But this is a non-Newtonian aspect, is that viscosity is a function of stress. Okay, that's a non-Newtonian characteristic. The other main non-Newtonian characteristic we care about when we're dealing with graphics is something that isn't on this list at all. It's a fourth kind of thing to think about, and that is elasticity. Okay, elasticity is just the property that after you deform, it wants to go back. We often talk about elasticity in the form of If you have two particles, you act like they have a little spring between them. The farther they go away, the more they want to come back to where they started. And mass spring models, little balls and simulated springs, are a common way of making like sponge simulations and so on in graphics. They're easy to compute, purely local computations. They work great. Now, a lot of fluids have elasticity. But they have what's actually called elastoviscosity, because the elasticity will change a little bit with some plasticity. Notably, elasticity pulls them back. The complement to that is plasticity, which is it breaks long springs. So it breaks long springs and makes new ones. So if you can hold it in a tense form position, it will stop thinking it's tense and will reset its base position. It breaks long springs and makes new short ones. Okay? So if we imagine a spring between every pair of fluid molecules, it will break them if they get stretched too long or stay stretched too long, and will make new short ones. It will reset the internal geometry. But this gives us a really messy thing from Newton's model, where everything's just particles moving around, because this suggests there's some sort of history or memory in what's going on. Okay? So the history or memory of the fluid means it wants to go back to where it was a while ago, but it's sort of a finite memory. It won't go back arbitrarily far. If you keep it stretched, it will stay stretched. And so if you have this sort of self-plastic elasticity added into the rest of fluidity, you get elastoviscosity. Elastoviscosity is actually very common. Many fluids you interact with have this behavior, and it causes patterns in motion. So for example, if you squeeze honey, you'll see it will like make a little woo-woo-woo-woo-woo. It'll go in circles. That is caused by the elasticity of the fluid. There's a little bit of elasticity in the fluid itself that causes it to wobble back and forth. Oscillation is a characteristic of elasticity, right? So many thick fluids you're used to have elasticity. The most extreme versions of this are things like Jell-O and hair gel, which will jiggle, right? They have so much elasticity that small motions will just make them jiggle in place with no long-term deformations. But you can still squish them and moosh them around to some degree. And so when we're simulating fluids to make interesting-looking fluids, we need to deal with elastoviscosity and then also stress-modulated viscosity in what we are doing. Yes?
So I'm a little bit confused about the diagram here. What is the separation between Newtonian and non-Newtonian?
Newtonian is just these three. Mm-hmm. And then the non-Newtonian includes elasticity and viscosity varying with stress.
Okay, so for Newtonian fluids, viscosity doesn't vary with stress?
Yes, for Newtonian fluids, viscosity is just a constant. Okay. Momentum is preserved and it's incompressible or not. Yep. And we add these two others. In general, anything a fluid does that Newton didn't describe would be non-Newtonian. But these are the two that graphics generally deals with, is elasticity and stress. There is surface tension is technically generally considered non-Newtonian, but for whatever reason, we understood surface tension a lot earlier, and so when we talk about non-Newtonian fluids, we're not usually talking about surface tension, because we just sort of assume people have fixed that already. Anyway, but surface tension does technically fit in this non-Newtonian as well, where the liquid wants to go in towards itself is essentially the source of surface tension.
So were you saying that latex paint is non-Newtonian?
Correct. It is sheer thinning, which is non-Newtonian. Watercolor is. It's water.
Okay, even though water has surface tension?
Water has surface tension, so in a physics class we would call it non-Newtonian. In fact, we wouldn't be able to come up with a Newtonian fluid. But in graphics, we consider surface tension to sort of not be in the non-Newtonian space, even though we know Newton didn't understand it. All right, so we have these ideas. We're going to try to talk about how we deal with these. Let's start with elasticity. Viscoelastic fluids are easy with particle-based mesh-free simulations. You just add a little spring between every particle, and you add a spring force that tries to pull things or push things after you simulate. And then you reset the springs, or you let them stretch out a little bit. And this will give you elastoviscosity. For a grid, it's a lot messier. There's a lot more work to do to make it work on a fixed grid than on moving particles, but it's not a complicated addendum on a particle-based fluid simulation. But stress thinning and thickening, that's a little bit different. So let's talk a little bit about this. And we're going to come back to how we actually simulate fluids. To do that, we're going to talk about a principle of fields, the Helmholtz, oh no, I forgot the other person's name. Who's the other person with Helmholtz that made the decomposition of vector fields? Hodge, that's it. All right, the Helmholtz-Hodge, nope, because we don't want, the Helmholtz-Hodge decomposition. This is a principle of vector fields. Oh, this doesn't have the picture I wanted. No! I think Joss Stamm has it. Let's see if we can find Joss Stamm's paper about this. No! Okay, maybe I can find the image, because I know it's in his paper. I was going to draw this myself, but I really didn't want to. Nope! Those are not the images I wanted. Okay. All right, we want stable, simple, no, not stable, stable FFT fluids, just, sorry, I had this download and then I realized I downloaded it on the wrong computer, and I don't have it with me. Yeah, nope, that's not going to be the paper itself. Where is the paper? Here, all right. So this is a paper that was published, I believe, if memory serves, in 1995, when graphics was first figuring out how to do fluids well. No, and this is not the one I wanted. This is just the one that shows good picture, good final results. Wow. I had no trouble finding this before. No. Nope. Ah, I'm sorry. This one might work. This is not the original, but this will work. Yes, okay. Here is the picture of the Helmholtz-Hodge decomposition. Given any vector field, you can always write it as the sum of two other vector fields, where one of them is divergence-free, and the other one is only divergence. Okay? So this one just swirls, and this one just clumps. This one is the gradient of a scalar field. This is the curl of a field. Defining curl is a little complicated in 3D. But anyway. This decomposition is commonly used to simulate fluids. We take whatever momentum and spring forces and so on would cause our fluid to do, and we break it down into a circulation field and a divergence field. And then we just subtract, the simplest way is we just subtract divergence. And then we'll get a circulation preserving field instead. And that's sort of what we did when we derived some linear equations before. Okay? Linear equations before were just how we change this field to not have that component. We dealt with a little bit of a matrix last week. However, knowing what this field gives us some stress. From this field, if we can find the scalar field this is the gradient of, that scalar field is the pressure of the fluid. And the pressure of the fluid is a good proxy for the stress the fluid is under, and therefore a good proxy for measuring all of these sorts of thinning and thickening properties. So what we want to do is take our vector field, and in addition to making it not have divergence, to make it incompressible, we also want to know what pressure would have been needed to remove that. What was the gradient field we would have needed to remove, to create that? The function that determines the gradient field from this. So the straight up finding how much divergence there is, this is not easily solvable. Okay? This is a linear system of equations. And the linear system of equations we're going to use is called the discrete Poisson I don't remember if it's an equation or a formula or the discrete Poisson. The web knows discrete Poisson. Not to be confused with discrete Poisson. Equation. Okay. So the discrete Poisson equation. We could go through the derivation of it, but it turns out to be this sparse matrix. It's always square, as it turns out, and why it's always square is, we're not going to go there. But it turns out to be this very nice, what's called block tridiagonal matrix. So if you have a rectangular grid, this matrix will always have D's along the main diagonal, where that looks like a tridiagonal matrix, 4's and negative 1's. And then it will have negative identity matrix off the main diagonal. Why is this a structure it has? It does. You can work it around. But there's lots of nice properties about the final matrix you get. It is sparse. It is block tridiagonal. It is symmetric. It is positive semi-definite. It has various nice properties that make it very easy to solve. And it's been really well studied. Okay, in general, solving linear systems of equations is considered to be cubic. But there's known an algorithm that uses it in 2.5. Oh, wait, we did better. We could do 1.5. No, wait, we can do n log n. No, we got n. Hooray, big O n. For the exact solution, and we can often get the approximate solution in also big O n, but a much smaller constant. Okay, so we can solve this very well. So what we typically do when we're dealing with fluids, okay, there's different ways of handling this, but a common process. We're going to use all of our non-incompressible preserving functions. So we're going to have momentum using some kind of advection. Often back advection, but it could be other kinds of advection instead. Okay, we're going to add things like gravity, user forces, etc. All of these external forces. Okay, that will change the fluid flow as well. We might add things like elasticity by having some sort of spring going on. Okay. And all of these will change all of the particles or cells' positions in an uncontrolled way. This does not create things that are incompressible. We could add viscosity at this space, but if we want to have any kind of stress thinning or stress thickening going on, we're then going to solve a Poisson equation. Okay? To get pressure, a pressure field. Okay. The pressure field's gradient, which is straightforward to solve, will give us how to remove the portions of motion we don't want. We can also use the pressure field to do other things. So with the pressure, we can then use that pressure. We can use the pressure to do non-Newtonian viscosity. Okay. And then we can use the pressure to make incompressible. Often in practice, we actually redo, for exact incompressibility, we'd redo the Poisson equation because the viscosity will change the vector field. So you might need to do that twice. So we can make it incompressible. And then we're done. We can loop around again, go back to advection. Okay? And so these are pieces we might use in a fluid simulation. Many fluid simulations just want to do water or small amounts of gloopy stuff that we don't need all of the features for. And so we might be able to avoid dealing with stress thinning or stress thickening or the like. And sometimes some of these steps won't work beautifully for some things we want to do, and so we may add some extra things around it. But these are basic steps of what's going to go on. Questions about any of these steps? All right. Because, you know, we can. Let's just look at a video. If we look for videos of non-Newtonian fluids. Oh, right. I don't want just general videos of non-Newtonian fluids. I want SIG graph videos of non-Newtonian fluids. Ah, this one has some beautiful pictures. All right. So, this was 2 years ago, I think. We put some bunnies made out of different fluids on a surface. Okay? The one that doesn't have any stress anything just flows away, but the other ones do other things. So actually, let's pause and back up there and talk a little bit about what's happening. Okay? First off, some of them are sticking and some of them aren't. Stickiness is friction, is caused by the same underlying physics as viscosity. In particular, they're both caused by the fact that objects at temperature vibrate perpendicular to the direction of motion and bump into each other. Okay? And so the things we use for viscosity for the liquid, we use for stickiness here. We say the liquid has viscosity with the stationary slope behind, and that causes it to stop. Okay? And so we get this stickiness there. And then one of these has more of the stress thickening than the other, right? So this one is flowing more like mayonnaise, and this one is flowing more like, I don't know, some sort of rubbery paint. Because this one has a higher rest viscosity, but more thinning going on, okay? Compared to the water, which just runs and doesn't really care. The reason we get complete sticking is because where it's pressed against the surface, there's quite a lot of pressure holding up the entire fluid above it. And so we can guarantee, as it thins out, that pressure drops, but so does the force of gravity. And so we can make it completely stick by making that viscosity proportional to the slope, to the pressure that applies. Okay? And so, as it always happens, we take basic models and we make them do different things. So we can say, what if your elasticity is nice and high? Or what if your elasticity, you have Bingham plastic? Okay? Or if you have a shear thickening, right? It hits and is hard, but then as it rests, it flops. Okay? So in a high stress, it just hits solidly, right? Okay? Codimensionality. Let's pause and see a better picture of codimensionality. All right, this will be a better one. Okay, here is bad visualization, okay? Unlike usual graphics, they didn't spend a huge amount of time figuring out the right way to draw bread. But here we have this effort to make mayonnaise. Or toothpaste, or I don't know, wall patch cream, or who knows, right? They called it mayonnaise. But then this is the thing they really wanted to say, ooh, we did something cool. Okay? What are they doing? First off, oh, it's going to be hard to notice. We're going to have to turn off some lights. Okay, there are grooves. The serration of the knife left permanent grooves. We have these little breaking bits things here, right? We have this behaving like something that could actually exist. How do we get there? So there's a whole lot of things. This paper has many different pieces. It's actually a very confusing paper to read, this particular one, because it basically just says, here are 15 other papers. We're mixing all their things and adding a few little pieces. And so it's, unless you've read the other papers, 15 is an exaggeration. Sorry, I think it's only 4 that they really base it off of. Anyway, but unless you've read all these other papers, it's a very confusing paper to read through. But The basics of what they're doing here, they're treating this as a Bingham plastic. They say its rest viscosity is quite high. It has to have some amount of pressure before anything happens. So these grooves, gravity does not provide enough pressure for them to go away. Okay? It'll flatten to some degree and then it'll stop. So we have an infinite viscosity if there's not enough pressure. And the viscosity will decrease as pressure is applied. So that allows us to create the grooves. To create this splitting, though, we have codimensionality. This is really niche. Okay? Codimensionality was, it's maybe 4 or 5 years old study in fluid simulations. But here's the basic idea. All right. Remember when we talked about simplices? And we said we can have a 0 simplex, or a 1 simplex, or a 2 simplex, or a 3 simplex. The idea of codimensionality is we're going to try to simulate with all of these at once. We're going to have a mesh that we impose over a group of moving particles. We're going to use the mesh to decide the physics of what's going on. But we're going to allow some parts of the mesh to be volumes, some to be planes, some to be lines, and some to be free points. Figuring out which one to do and then figuring out a nice smooth transition is the tricky part here. Okay? So when we have just a point, we're treating it as a spherical droplet. And so what it needs to know is sort of how much stuff does it have? What is the actual volume or radius of this point? Okay? Because it's representing some amount of volume, we need to know how much volume. It has no other behaviors. It just is a point. So it can move, it doesn't have orientation, it doesn't have to deal anything like this. This is going to represent some sort of little string of water. Okay? Or so this needs to know its volume. But it also has rotation. It can spin as it goes. It can stretch out. It can have internal stresses. So we also need some sort of 1D fluid laws. How stretched does it have to be before it pops into two things, or collapses into one and turns into a ball? Okay? So we have to make some sort of approximations of strings of fluid. And then we need approximations of planes of fluid. So we need something about thickness, which in general might, and this is actually also true of the lines, might vary over the course. So each of the points is going to have some amount of thickness. And then we need to have rules about how thickness moves between one point and another, and then how the points move together. We can derive all of these from understandings about surface tension and fluid dynamics coming out of the Navier-Stokes equation. The math is a little tedious, we won't go through it. And then we have a volume. Okay, this doesn't have thickness, it's just a size, right? Once we turn it into a volumetric simplex, there is nothing we store besides the points in their motion, because the contents of it is everything. Okay, so while these ones have this sort of variable parameter, how much liquid are they really, this one does not. It's geometrically encoded inside the volume itself. And so the idea of codimensional fluid simulation is we have rules for how all of these interact, how they change from one to another, how they can merge, how they can split, how small enough tetrahedra will turn into planes. And so the process here generally involves some sort of, we'll do some sort of fluid step, and then we will typically do some sort of remeshing. Where we'll say, okay, this tetrahedron is really thin, let's turn that into a plane. This plane is getting too thick, let's turn it into a volume. This line is too long, let's split it into two droplets. And rules about how each of those topology changes impact the behavior of the fluid underneath. This is why it takes several other papers to understand the paper that does this. Okay? But as a consequence, right here where we see the goop squeezing with the knife, we have a volume turning into a plane, going out into a line to make that little connection, and they actually simulated droplets that they decided fell away in this particular instance. We'll get to see some droplets later, to make the whole pieces work. Okay? And they also have, because this is stress thinning, they can spread it over the bread. Okay? So here we have planes that are falling into holes and turning into volumes, right? All simulated, and they have to do quite aggressive remeshing, where the knife and the bread get really close together, you make very dense points and so on. So they're actually doing variable resolution here and so on to try to make it fit to the places it needs to be. This is one of those papers that has videos but no timing measurements, which always tells you something. And because we understand how viscosity changes with heat, you can do things like melting cheese. Cheese is a Bingham plastic. Its viscosity depends on its heat. So you can do hot slices of pizza, and then slightly cooler cheeses, just by increasing the elasticity, and you'll get bigger sheets. You probably would have to watch it a dozen times to really notice the difference. Anyway, right? But then with a really cool thing, in my opinion, is what they figured out how to do with paints. So let me actually jump ahead to where they do my favorite part of the paints. Oh. From time to time in graphics, you create a simulation and it does something you don't expect, and then you find out that physicists already knew. So here they decide, let's squirt some paint. Okay? But notice what's happening here and here. We have this weird twisting of this thin film of paint. We have a thin film of paint because paint is stress thinning. Okay? So as it's moving quickly, it stretches out and forms these thin sheets. But we have these twists. It turns out this is a known phenomena. It's an interaction with stress thinning and surface tension and things. And I don't know if the authors of this paper said, let's see if we can get this, or if they said, let's squirt a thin film and let's see what happens. I don't know which one they did, okay? But this is the one I find most interesting. Let's gloop some paint onto something that spins around. It'll get better, trust me. Then we'll just spin it up. Wah! Right? So you can see we have the one-dimensional, we have solids, we have two-dimensional, we have it all in this picture, right? And the fact that they can move smoothly between it and deal with centrifugal force and rotation and large-scale rotation and so on, they're like, yes, we got it all to work. And that's how they managed to write a paper which basically says, here's 15 things other people did, we're adding it together, right? Because putting it all together is fairly complicated and it creates cool shots like this. Yes?
How long does it typically take someone to read like a whole paper?
Typically. That's a good question. So the first time I did this class, we spent an entire day and a half reading a paper together. The second time I did this class, we started doing that in 10 minutes in the class rebelled. We can do that again. There is an art to reading technical papers. And the more of them you do, the better you get at it. There is also an art in writing a technical paper where people read it, will say, ah, I understand what you did, but then not be able to replicate it and beat you to the next step. Okay? And so almost all papers in this space will give you enough details that if you know what's going on, you can say, okay, I see what your new cool thing is, and I think it was worth publishing. But leave out enough that you're going to spend an extra year figuring out what was the little trick they did there. And so they get, yeah. Every once in a while, we find one that somebody says, okay, here's a 20-year-old technology, I'm just going to tell you how to do it. But many of the newer ones will be very full of, not fluff, they'll just leave out things that people that know the space says, yes, I know that's theoretically possible, it's not, I believe you did that step, but leave out all the details about how that worked. So often, for example, they will just say, we solved the pressure equation. And you'll say, okay, what did the pressure equation look like for this thin film? And you have no idea, and so you go look at their related works that first mention thin films, and they sort of hand wave the important things that change, but then you try to make the matrix, and it ends up being rectangular, and you're like, ah, right, and so on. Yes?
So is that for like a monetary benefit
or something? It's partly just because we ask for short papers. Okay? A paper is supposed to represent the new ideas, and not supposed to be a textbook. But it is partly for monetary benefit, right? You don't, and partly for just in the future, you want to be able to be the one that can do it. There are various movements in the computing education or computing publishing community from time to time to require source code that works and replicates your experiments. And sometimes this happens and then it stops happening in any way. I don't know if in the long run this will become a thing or not. Although it is also the case that you can release source code and reveal nothing about how things work. Okay? Which I actually discovered a real concrete example of this recently when I had a group of students that were working on trying to write a plugin for an open source code editor and found out that the open source code that was released had no comments, not a single comment anywhere in the almost 500,000 lines of code. Like, okay, somebody wrote comments. There's another version of this source code I don't have, right? And anyway. So there's lots of ways of sort of maintaining your edge, staying ahead. And I don't know how often this is consciously done and how often it's accidental, but it does happen a fair amount. How many of you would be interested in spending a day learning how to read a particular paper? No, that sounds dry. Wow, close to half and half. I'll think about it. It's a little bit more than half that want to do it, so we may give it a try, or may do half a day on it or something. Other questions? Yeah?
How do you do lighting influence? How do you...
All the stuff we talked about with ray tracers still works. So they're transparent. But let's just sort of... Sorry?
You like have a lot of particles, but...
Oh, right. Yes, sorry. We mentioned this a few times, but let's reiterate how it works. Okay. We have a bunch of particles. We want them to represent a smooth surface. Each of them represents some amount of mass. So each of those creates a potential field. Then we use blobbies to extract some sort of polygonal boundary around them. And then the most important things to understand about common fluids and how we want to render them is we usually are going to use refraction. So as we enter and exit the fluid boundary, we will decrease and then re-increase our angle. We will typically also use some sort of homogeneous attenuation of light. So we'll measure the distance we traveled before we exit and use that distance as how dark the light got over the time it was there or what color it became. Okay? So that's the easiest way to do sort of dyed colored fluids. If they need to look creamy or like dirty jello, for lack of a better word, we'll need to use subsurface scattering instead, which will just sort of a random chance for any unit distance traveled that will just jump in a random direction is how ray tracers do that. So you just say, you know, what is the half distance before you hit something? And so we'll have some chance for any given length that you would have bounced off earlier in a random direction and then repeat that is the core understanding of subsurface scattering. And yeah, other questions about rendering fluids?
So are these like all ray traced?
The pictures we've been showing have virtually all been ray traced, yes. We have approximations of all, like the how far did you go attenuate? Well, you can't do translucency without ray tracing, right? The 2D, the rasterizer, your homework 3, or homework 4, sorry, your homework 2 or homework 4 won't be able to do glass, won't be able to do water at all. But if we make them opaque, then it's fair game to do that. Or if we make them shiny using some sort of approximate method where we have a given your normal, here's what you should look at kind of simulations, those can work too. I say this and then I realize I have to make a caveat. If you care enough about any specific visual phenomena, you can figure out how to make a reasonable approximation in a rasterizer. That may mean you simulate, you like draw the front faces and the back faces of every object and use some sort of post-processing step to create some simulation of refraction, right? There's things like this you can do. But the work for any specific phenomena is quite large where it goes fairly linearly with ray tracing. Yes?
So like in a video game, they would do that sort of method where you can rasterize water?
In a video game, they will usually just ignore refraction. So usually in a video game, they'll try to give some simulation of surface physics, surface phenomena, right? Some sort of like, here is the shiny, bubbly surface. And then they'll just not do refraction, right? So the simplest version of this, like if we have, I don't know, if you put your stick in the pool and here it hits the water, and they will keep drawing your stick straight after that. That's not how refraction works. Right? It, because your right legs end up going at a steeper angle, it's going to look like it bent. Or like the whole pool is sort of squished. And if we know we have perfectly flat stuff, then we could actually render below this and then above it with different depth buffers and render the stuff below it with a matrix that squashes it, right? If you know you have a flat surface, you could do that. But what if it was a lumpy surface? Well, maybe we can chop it right and so on. So if you know exactly what you're doing, you can always simulate this. But usually what we'll do is we'll just put some sort of filmy, watery surface texture and then make the stuff behind it darker. For the easiest ones to do. Other questions? All right. Yeah. Okay. All right. We have a couple papers linked today. Let's take a look at these papers. Oh, this one actually had the picture I wanted. Huh, I linked to it and forgot. All right. This is an example of a paper that says, here's how to do it. All right. Joss Stamm was a really big early in the days of visual simulation. Worked at the University of Toronto and then was hired by Alias Wavefront that makes some of the highest end graphics tools. And basically here he published this to sort of say, Alias Wavefront has a fancier one than this, let me tell you the simple one. And thus it was marketing for Wavefront, so they were happy with it. And it was useful for a lot of people. So this paper, unlike most others, it has the math, that is usual. It then tries to draw pictures of the math. It tries to draw actual diagrams about how your code should be put together. And then it has source code. Like actual source code, you can run source code. And it keeps going and has more source code all the way down, including like, how do you actually go about solving the linear systems of equation? And it has your nice, what are we trying to do along the way and why do we want it? And then it has, here is how you actually make it incompressible. Do this, here is the source code, okay? This paper goes all the way through all of it and ends up with, as they say here, this algorithm presented in this paper is one of the simplest fluid solvers one can write. It is a little bit over 100 lines of readable C code. Okay? Is this readable? It's not horrible. It's not horrible. Every once in a while he has like, really? But it's not too bad. There's no comments, but there's a whole paper around it. And then there's some things about how would you make this a little bit cooler. And then they have, here's what we did with this actual thing. You run this code, you can create these simulations, okay? So this is, and then of course they have, and here are things you can't do, okay? Other cool things we know how to do that is sort of related to this, right? But they have other tests. There are sort of the standard tests. So this is the heating test. You make this fluid at the bottom want to go up and the fluid at the top want to go down. And you get, depending on the temperature, either big swirls or little plumes. This is called the somebody-somebody vortex street. The Von somebody vortex street? Ah! He probably says. Von Karman vortex street. Okay. If you have the right level of viscosity and you flow fluid around a cylinder, it will spin off opposite direction vortices that will last for a very long time and flow with the liquid. It's a known phenomenon of 2D fluids, and it's a common way of measuring can you get your viscosity to the right level. Then they have the what happens if you tilt two miscible fluids. Anyway, there's sort of standard experiments to say this actually does something vaguely like math. It also reveals there's quite a lot of blurring. We don't have a lot of details here. And so there are other papers that say we've done it better. But this is a paper if you want to say, okay, this is cool, but I want code, give me code. Here you go. This is the most simple code I know. Second most simple code I know, maybe. The FFT one is also pretty simple, but it's a little bit hard to understand why it works. So this is one that we have available. Another one we have here is about shallow water. This is actually about erosion. So this one is about terrain. And it says if we put water on the edges and we let it flow in and flow out, things should get flatter. And it talks about how to simulate this. But this deals with what's called the shallow water equations. And if memory serves me, I picked this one because I had a pretty good picture. Yeah. The idea of shallow water is that we're only storing heights. Okay? In this one, they're storing heights of mud and heights of water. We aren't storing anything about motion internally. We're trying to figure out if you just have relatively shallow water deeper here than over there, how does it flow? Shallow meaning we don't have to worry about internal eddies. The height of the water is all we care about. Okay? And so shallow water is sort of a well-understood phenomena. We have good equations for how it works. It actually acts like a compressible fluid. So this paper does a reasonable job about explaining how they actually did this calculation because the paper isn't about the calculation. Right? So they're explaining how they did it because they're using it for something else, and so it's not going to let anybody else trounce their work. Anyway, I don't think that's actually why they did it. I think they're just pretty good at writing papers. But this talks about this idea. The core idea of shallow water in its most common form is we measure water as a bunch of columns. Okay? And then we want to say, at any given point in time, how much water flows from one column to the next? Okay? And so we want to have some notion of the flow of the water. And basically, the more different the height is, the more pressure there is to move, to increase the flow. So we can either do it as flows, or sometimes you'll see it as momentums of the height. You can get equivalent formulations either way. We'll measure how quickly is water flowing into and out of each one. If more is flowing in than out, it rises. If more is flowing out than in, it shrinks. And if it's higher than the ones around it, it's going to push water away. This is really easy to simulate. It's especially easy in this sort of one dimension of water, one dimension of depth kind of space. But out, if you want to make it the surface of real regular water, it works quite well. It's easy enough to simulate that there are like screensavers that actually simulate this to make drops of things rippling across your screen and still have spare cycles left over to do some simulation of refraction. Right? It's just a straightforward, almost all local phenomena that will create waves in basic simulations. And so there are simplifications of liquids we can use. They're very efficient if we know what we won't accept. Now, what this lacks is a weird phenomena about water. let's just do this. Big waves go fast. Hey, this is a phenomenon of liquids. The larger the wave, the faster it moves. This is always the case. One of the phenomena this means in shallow water, when you have a big wave, okay, this water is going to move faster than this water because it's closer to the ground. And that means as it moves forward, it's not going to stay this shape. It's going to crest. Because the deeper water can move faster. And this creates cresting waves and surf and so on like that. I can't simulate this with columns. I can simulate the basic idea of faster, bigger water moves faster, but I can't simulate the idea that this water is deeper than this water on the same wave. And so the top of the wave is moving faster than the bottom. And so we don't get all of the phenomena we would want, but we get much of the phenomena we would want with this. We can also use big waves move fast to simulate the surface of an ocean with no math at all, or virtually no math at all. So let's talk about how we would do that. We will just make a blobby image. Okay? We will have some darker regions and some paler regions. We'll just sort of make a blobby image and imagine that this was smooth instead of me scribbling. Okay? We'll usually make it tile so that it wraps around nice and smooth. We pick one of these. We use this as a height map to displace things. Okay? That's not enough. We're going to make a half-size copy of it and a quarter-size copy of it and maybe a few other levels. And then we're going to move them all. We're going to move the big one fast, and the middle-sized one not as fast, and the small one quite slowly. And we'll add them on top of each other. And poof, it will look like water. It will look like waves in the open sea. And it's straightforward, it's easy to do, it involves nothing other than offsetting textures and adding them to each other. Hooray! No simulation, okay? So, yes. This is a height map, yeah.
Like it would look like waves as viewed directly perpendicular.
Well, directly above waves don't look like very much, but you would even apply this to a mesh to decide the elevation of a fixed XY.
Okay.
Yes?
There are four red squares in that green square, right?
Correct. Yeah, so we tile all of them. And you can actually do this where they just rotate inside their tile and you never actually move them. You just like copy a pixel over. Anyway. Yeah, there are different approaches to make this efficient. But this can create convincing looking waves. Sufficiently convincing looking that I actually once showed this to somebody, and after a while of it being on the screen, they started feeling seasick. So, you know, we won't go there. But it's very easy to do. And this is actually commonly the case, right? We started by talking about the real physics of it. But at some point, you can just give the phenomena. And if that's all you care about, it's good. If I then tried to put a boat on this, it would not look convincing. Because boats mess up how water moves, right? But if I just have open sea, we're good to go. And for something like a video game, where I really don't want to waste cycles computing the water most of the time, right? I can have the surface of the boat, and then I can make sure you never get close enough to the edge to realize it doesn't work well at the edge of the boat. And then we can have the waves simulated by this out in the distance with decreasing resolution and distance, so I don't need to deal with it, right? This gives me a height map, but I don't have to have a pixel in every point, right? And so if you wanted to have the boat on the open seas with choppy water, you'd make the boat rock like this, and completely independent of that, you'd have this water scrolling by and just never let people see the interface, right? A lot of tricks like this can make things faster and simpler. And if you really do care about the interface, that's likely to be a game element and we're spending time computing some simulation of physics for. Thoughts, comments, questions about water? Or other liquids, yes?
Is this physics calculation done on the processor, like CPU or GPU?
Is which one done there? All right, what is it that the CPUs can do that GPUs can't?
You have to do one thing faster, or several things.
They can do debugging. Hey, there used to be all kinds of constraints on GPUs, but basically they aren't always faster. If you don't write your code right, they're not faster. So there's some sort of data structures that don't work well on them. But it's really hard to debug them. So prototype code is on the CPU. Almost across the board. When we come up with a new phenomena, we run it on the CPU. And then if we decide it's important, and we think it has a sort of a parallelizable structure, we spend a lot more effort without adding any new concepts and transform it into the GPU. Occasionally along the way, we can come up with a cool new data structure. But often it's a whole lot of work to make it more efficient, and then it ends up being a lot more efficient. There is work going on in the parallel programming community about how do we let you write code for a GPU in a way that makes sense, and how do we give you debugging information, and can we simulate it, and so on, right? And so we're getting better at that. We're already so much better. When I first taught this class 5 years ago, that isn't how this conversation went. The conversation went, you can't rely on people having a GPU that can run your GPU code, so you write it on the CPU, right? That isn't what we say anymore, because 5 years have changed the scene, okay? And we've gotten a lot better at writing languages for it, and we've got better compute shaders and so on. So in time, we'll probably stop thinking as much about the difference. But right now, let's just say, as an estimate, triple the time to get it running on the GPU. As in triple your time, not its time. Other, yeah?
Can you explain that?
Yeah, let me try looking at somebody else's picture. I actually didn't expect us to get here, so I didn't prepare for this. But let's hopefully. Okay, this is what I want, but then I want more of them. Nope. Maybe this won't work. No! I'm not finding what I want. Okay. Well, Let's start with this. Okay. Whoa. That was not what I expected to happen when I asked to view the image. Well, it'll still work. All right. Here I have a picture. This is a periodic picture. You tile it, it matches smoothly. It happens to have this sort of rigidy kind of effect to it. I may or may not care about that. It actually doesn't matter what that effect is. Okay? I have this picture. Let's actually try. Ooh. We're going to try some live demos, which is going to be a bad idea. I'm about to do something I'm going to regret. All right, that has a weird name. All right. Let's see if we can actually do what I'm talking about. No. All right. Graphics, where are you? I'm already regretting my decision, which I anticipated, so at least I'm good at guessing. Not that, no, that is not the image I wanted to open. We've seen that before, been a long time. All right, so here I have an image. Okay, so the idea that I want to do with the image is I want to make a copy of it. Where is my layers bar? Layers. Let's name this layer so it sticks around. We'll call this smaller. Okay, so I'm going to take this layer and I'm going to make it half the size. So I'm going to scale this layer. Scale layer. Here we are. To be one half the size. Okay, so now I've got a half size image. And then I want to make these additive. So let's see if I can make this do. Let's make that transparent, and let's make that transparent. Okay. And now in this region where they overlap, I have some large scale data and I have some small scale data. And if I come in and I move one of these, right, as I move this across, I get this sort of, okay, I don't know why that did that. Ah, okay, that cropped for some reason. I don't know why that happened. Layer, I have the move tool, right? Yep. Nope, I don't. I don't know why it's not moving. Ah, no. Well, all right, this isn't going to work well. It just crops. All right. The principle is I make different size images, I move them at different speeds. the big one twice as fast as the half-size one, twice as fast as the quarter-size one, add them all up together, and then I use the brightness to be height. So I use white is high, dark is low, and I map that onto the surface and I get waves. Sorry, that was not a great explanation. Is it any better though? All right. Sometimes a bad demo still works. Other questions? Yeah?
Is this sort of how the, well, it's not exactly the same, but like that WebGL water demo that we saw before, I saw it was like the way that it would I think, do the height of the water. I think it would like put a drop down into a texture and like diffuse that drop sort of across the texture and use that texture as like a new water net, for example. I wonder if that's something.
So this is, I believe, the shallow water equation. Yep, this is using the shallow water equation on the surface. Okay, and this is the one that crashed my computer last time, so we're going to watch this bar very closely. All right, so the idea here is when I press, it's going to create a depression, and then it uses this move to the next one to create the ripples. Yeah. Other questions? We still have 3 minutes. I don't think we really want to talk about non-liquid dynamics right now. So anything else you want to talk about for 3 minutes? Yeah.
I was wondering if you could go through like the quiz questions.
Oh, yeah. We can go through quiz questions. I know how to do that. I hope I didn't miskey it. I didn't get a chance to look at this. I hope I can log in.
Yeah, there was one question that like almost everybody got wrong.
Yeah, I occasionally do miskey things, but we'll see. All right. Anyone's in particular you want to look at? Oh, well, this doesn't look nice.
Let's do the one at 0.04.
All right, in class we discussed a simplex structure based on a pair of arrays. Consider the structure of two simplices, triangles, not line segments, or tetrahedrons. Assuming the vertex is made of 3 4-byte values and that each index or pointer is 4 bytes, how much memory is needed to represent 4 triangular faces of a tetrahedron in this representation? Yeah, I'll bet you didn't expect to have to deal size ofs, did you?
No.
Yeah. All right. So, we need to have a tetrahedron. Okay? That means we have 4 points. We tell you how big points are. 3 4-byte values times 3 values times 4 bytes per value. Okay? Unit multipliers for the win. Is 48. Okay. And then we need to have 4 triangles. Okay. Where each triangle is going to be 3 vertexes plus 3 neighbors. Okay. Where a vertex and a neighbor is both, I believe we said, an index is 4 bytes.
So this can't add up to 72.
Yeah, it looks like it's keyed wrong. Yep, because that's 12 and 12 is 24 times 4 is 96. Yeah, so keyed wrong. Any others we should talk about?
So for that one, how could you get the neighboring vertices in O of one time? I don't know how you, because you don't associate, each vertex doesn't know what simplices it's a part of. So you'd have to do at very least an O of F lookup to figure out what simplices a vertex is part of.
Oh. Yeah, okay. I was unclear about how that works. I will add additional correct answers. Other questions? While I'm adding points to you. All right. I will see you all on Thursday.